From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
The transition is finally over. What comes next? Hello again, I'm Oren Olney, and this is To the Point. For the 45th time, America has accomplished a peaceful transition of power, leaving the country with a sense of uncertainty about the future. President Donald Trump's inaugural address repeated familiar themes from his campaign for office.
America first. America first.
But he painted a dark picture of the nation's current condition and promised to disempower the Washington elite, but he was short on specifics. Did he reassure the majority of Americans who voted for Hillary Clinton? We'll hear details and get a variety of reactions. Later on today's Talking Point, the White House press corps may be kicked out of the building. Could that produce a renaissance in political journalism? First, the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. President Trump is the least popular incoming chief executive in recent history, and he's publicly declared that the news media are part of the opposition. We'll hear a surprising response to the threat of throwing the White House press corps out of the White House. Today's inaugural address began with ringing repetitions of promises familiar from last year's speeches and rallies.
We assembled here today are issuing a new decree to be heard in every city, in every foreign capital, and in every hall of power. From this day forward, a new vision will govern our land. From this day forward, it's going to be only America first. America first.
The ceremony was brief. There were large crowds gathered outside in front of the West Wing of the Capitol. Josh Letterman is White House reporter for the Associated Press. Hi, Josh. Good to have you with us.
Great to join you, Warren.
The photographs from above show that there was a large crowd. We're told that it was mixed. There were opponents as well as people who were in favor of the president. How would you assess the address in terms of the transition from the campaign to the new administration?
We didn't hear a major change in tone from the president compared to when he was president-elect or when he was presidential candidate. He was unapologetic. He was not seeking to really reach out to the Americans who didn't vote for him. There weren't any kind of calls for unity among supporters and opponents like you sometimes see after a divisive election. Instead, he really went back to the themes that made him so successful in the campaign: economic populism, nationalism, talking about how bleak America is, all of the American carnage, and pledging to really give some power to what he called the forgotten men and women in America. So if people were expecting or hoping that President Trump would sound different than he did as a candidate and more somebody who was going to be president for all people, so far the indications are that he is sticking to the voice that he's had for the last few years.
Did he speak at all to the diversity of the country?
He did have some references to that and talked about, some of the various principles of the country that apply to all of us, regardless of, what our background might be. But it was certainly not a focal point of his speech.
The Trumps and the Obamas met beforehand. They had a coffee together before they left in limousines to go up to the Capitol itself. You saw some of that and were relatively up close to it. How do they appear to be getting along?
You know, both of them were very gracious to one another. Trump praised Obama. The ex-president Obama was welcoming, showing, you know, the new president sort of where to stand and helping him as he had his reception at the White House. So there were no open signs of bitterness between them, even as Trump in his speech was decrying, you know, what he described as the sorry state of America right now. And at the White House right now, I have to tell you, it's a very strange experience here. At the moment, Obama is gone. Trump has not yet returned from the swearing in. And right now, it's kind of a no man's land. The offices are empty. And really, the only people that are populating it are, reporters, government workers from other agencies who sort of do the housekeeping and groundwork. It's like a White House without a president for just a few hours, Warren.
Somebody remarked that you can't make this transition with two guys in a truck. So how long do you think it's going to take to get the furniture in, to get the files in order and all of that? And has the Obama administration taken a lot of files with it?
Well, all of Obama's files that are work-related have to be archived by the National Records and Archives Administration under law. Obama's belongings are all gone at this point, having been removed in the last few hours, and also some of his imprints just on the building more generally. The photographs that are usually lined the walls of Obama's 8 years in office are all down. There are big white spaces there that seem to be beckoning the new president to sort of fill them with his own imagery, and Trump stuff is being moved in. We've seen some furniture being carried over from nearby buildings, some moving trucks around starting to bring in some of his belongings, but it will be a while still until he and his staff get settled, learn the hang of it and the ropes of how to make things work around here, and really are in fully in control.
The former president has been helicoptered away from the Capitol building. He's on his way to California, or will be soon. Trump then signed papers establishing his cabinet members and other such thing in the Capitol building itself. So he hasn't showed up yet at the White House.
He has not. He is going to be proceeding along the parade to the White House. However, just in the last few minutes, we've seen violent clashes start to pick up again along the parade route, and police are now blocking the parade route from a lot of those protesters, some of whom earlier were crashing windows in nearby buildings and otherwise making their opposition heard.
All right, a lot of action of a different kind in Washington. Josh Letterman with the Associated Press. Thanks a lot.
Great to be with you.
In a moment, the transition's officially over, but there's much more to come. We'll hear more on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're not only back with To the Point. In today's inaugural address, Trump continued familiar themes. One was the fundamental message to his base of supporters, those who feel left out and ignored by the rich elite headquartered in Washington.
The establishment protected itself, but not the citizens of our country. Their victories have not been your victories. Their triumphs have not been your triumphs. And while they celebrated in our nation's capital, there was little to celebrate for struggling families all across our land.
Kathleen Hall Jamison is a professor, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. She is a learned veteran of many political transitions, but like most Americans, she watched this one on television. Kathleen Hall Jamison, good to have you back on our program.
It's good to be with you.
Most people, of course, saw it on television. They are the ones who will be the most important when it comes to reacting to it. What did you see? What do you think the messages were, and how effective were they?
Well, first, the speech does have many references to all and to the collectivity, and it does have one sentence that some people will hear differently than others. It's the sentence that says, when you open your heart to patriotism, there's no room for prejudice. So there's an attempt in the speech to unify. The problem the speech has is that when it talks about returning the government to the people, it moves into a line that says everyone is listening to you now, and you is then defined as the tens of millions who became part of an historic movement, the likes of which the world has never seen. That says that the you to whom power is being returned is not the people as a whole, but rather the Trump supporters. And that's a problematic inference in this speech. The other thing that's interesting about this speech is that the world community is going to hear this as a direct continuation of the campaign rhetoric. And now the inference that some made and were offering internationally that perhaps there would be a different candidate and president, that is, President Trump would not be the president of a zero-sum game view of the world, those people have been disabused of that notion. This is a speech infused with the idea that we are against them, the other nations, who are exploiting us, particularly in the areas of trade, but not paying their fair share in defense. There's no rhetoric here of community of nations, except when he calls on everyone to fight terrorism.
When you say that this was directed at a movement which he then sort of qualified down to the people who voted for him, is that particularly important given that he did not get a majority of the vote?
Yes. And one of the purposes of an inaugural address structurally is unifying the country, ensuring that those who didn't vote for a candidate nonetheless can say, yes, this is my president. I share values with him. We share common national values. And we are one people. I'm comfortable with the fact that this person is leading. And when inaugural addresses do that well, they put the divisions of the campaign behind us. They move out of campaign rhetoric into the rhetoric of governance. This is an inaugural infused with campaign rhetoric. That is not going to unify in the way that an inaugural has a capacity to unify.
Kathleen Hall Jamison again at the University of Pennsylvania. Here is something that the president said that did seem to be recognizing the diversity of the country.
Whether we are black or brown or white, we all bleed the same red blood of patriots.
Mary Kate Carey is a White House, or was a White House speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. She is now Senior Fellow for Presidential Studies at the University of Virginia and a contributing editor at U.S. News World Report. Welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Generally speaking, there is a line like that in every inaugural speech, but of course, Donald Trump has managed to offend in the transition period and during the campaign, a lot of people who are black and brown and certainly Muslims. Did he follow through on what's traditional in that regard in this speech today?
Well, yeah, there were certain traditions that he stuck with. You know, going back to George Washington, Washington had two things in his speech. One was a lot of God. He started with a prayer. Donald Trump did not start with a prayer, which is what I was hoping he would do, and instead, but he did have references to the Bible and talked a lot about God. And then second, he talked about national unity to a degree. George Washington did a lot more, but Trump's speech, I think, was more of a populist America first sort of theme than it was about national unity.
George Washington warned against entangling alliances. We just heard Kathleen Hall Jamison say that he pretty much set up the United States versus the world community as us versus them. Is this a hark back to President Number One?
Yeah, he did make a few references, Warren, about new alliances and old alliances. But then, you know, also called out radical Islamic terrorism and said it will be eradicated from the face of the earth, which, you know, I think a lot of our allies would agree with. And so it wasn't totally in everybody's face. I think it was in some ways he's looking for more alliances, I think. And I think he wants to certainly have a better relationship with Russia. And so it's a new chapter. He's very much of a disruptor. And when he says these things, I don't think people should be too surprised. He was elected to sort of disrupt things.
When you say that he should have started with a prayer, he's not known as a particularly religious man.
No, he's not. But I thought it would have been humbling and would have set out on the right foot. He did have a lot more than usual number of other people praying before and after his speech. So I thought, you know, that he may be more religious than we know, but I thought the most consequential statement in the whole speech was the time for empty talk is over and now arrives the hour of action. And to me, that's he's acknowledging that the chips are down now and it doesn't really matter all his statements. We've got to see what he actually does. And maybe he's talking about his own speech, you know?
All right, Kate Carey, once again, former speechwriter for President George H.W. Bush. One person who has spent a lot of time with Donald Trump, more than most, is Timothy O'Brien. He wrote a book about Donald Trump, a biography, Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald. He was sued for that book and has the distinction of having won the suit. So he has a very interesting perspective on the new president of the United States. Timothy O'Brien, great to have you back. You're executive editor now of Bloomberg View. Good to talk with you once again.
Hi, Warren.
Did you see anything today that might have surprised you or changed your mind about Donald Trump and what you anticipated that he would do as president of the United States?
You know, it was funny. Earlier this morning, I was on an early morning panel on CNN, and CNN had done a survey of its own viewers about what they expected and wanted out of a Trump speech today. And the key theme that came out of that survey was unity, and that they were hoping that he would speak towards the idea of unity. And I think he really spoke about confrontation, America's confrontation with the world, America first, and also this notion that, you know, talk is over and now is a time of action. And I think specifically in that regard, a couple of times he emphasized that this is the people's government, this is a time for the people to take their government back. And I think that dovetails with his campaign rhetoric around jobs and the idea that he could bring coal jobs back to West Virginia, coal mining jobs, that he could bring industrial jobs back to the post-industrial regions in the upper Midwest, Michigan and Wisconsin. And he's going to be extremely hard-pressed to deliver on that. And he's coming into an economy that has rebounded probably as well as anyone could have expected from the 08 crisis. I think it's still very difficult for average workers. But for Trump to deliver jobs in an environment where he's also setting up a lot of rhetoric about divisions is going to be very, very tricky. He's promising a vision of the United States that he's going to have a hard time delivering on. And I'm not sure he's gotten his arms around what that's going to entail.
There were almost endless warnings about this between the time he was elected and today. People saying that unemployment is low, that the country is relatively prosperous, as you indicated, the economy is as good as might have been expected. And, of course, he's gotten a lot of some praise, but mostly criticism for what he's done in terms of claiming to have brought jobs back from Mexico that would have gone there otherwise. You're suggesting he's making promises he can't keep.
I think so. I mean, look, the rhetoric around Carrier, around those jobs in Indiana, the sort of drive-bys that he's engaged with the automobile companies, are very, it's very small beer. And he's taking credit for job initiatives that were already in motion before he got elected and aren't the kinds of job creations that are going to address the broader problems facing average blue-collar workers in this country. And his best option, I think, probably for delivering on his campaign promises around jobs is if he gets an infrastructure spending plan through. And he's projected he'll spend $1 trillion over a decade, so something like $100 billion a year, and he'll force that through Congress and to a party that is in conjunction with a party that's never been in favor of infrastructure plans. But if he can make that happen, then he'll be able to deliver some short-term job creation into some of these districts that he made those promises to. But that won't be private sector job growth. That'll be through public sector jobs and essentially through a program that some Democrats have espoused for years. And I think that it's still debatable whether he'll even have the GOP on his side for a program that is ambitious. So yeah, he's got a very high hurdle here.
You mentioned his support of infrastructure building, something that Democrats have supported. The only other person to make an extensive remark today, other than the president himself, was Chuck Schumer, who is the minority leader of the state Senate, of the U.S. Senate.
Today we celebrate one of democracy's core attributes, the peaceful transfer of power. And every day we stand up for core democratic principles enshrined in the Constitution, the rule of law, equal protection for all under law, the freedom of speech, press, religion.
Kathleen Hall Jamison, back to you. There has been talk that Chuck Schumer may be the senator that Donald Trump has the most in common with. They've spent a lot of time together. They know each other very well from New York. But when he talked about core Democratic principles, he might have made that meant that in a partisan sense as well as a generic sense.
Yeah, the Schumer speech was interesting. First, because it was long for its place in the order, but secondly, because it had a series of implied attacks on Donald Trump. That being unusual, because Donald Trump and Chuck Schumer are probably the two people working together who will deliver an infrastructure package which will help Donald Trump keep some of his promises.
What were the attacks on Schumer? On Trump, excuse me.
The democratic principles that are being articulated are those that liberals believe have been under assault by Donald Trump. You also have the assertion inside that speech that America is already great. That runs counter to the assumption in the Trump rhetoric that it isn't. It needs to be made great again. So what you're hearing is what is called tacit attack. If you know the context in which it is being spoken, you can hear the rhetoric it's playing against, and it's a rhetoric that says, we Democrats differ from you, Donald Trump.
Tim O'Brien, back to you. Is Donald Trump, given as well as you know him, somebody who sort of likes to have it on both sides?
I think Donald Trump, first and foremost, is someone who likes to get attention. I think we really have to understand that to date, the announcement of his candidacy, the way he ran during the primary and then in the general election, was as a vanity project. And he basks in the attention. He's got a deep-seated need to get attention. He has never demonstrated in essentially 50 years as an adult in the professional world long-term strategic thinking, emotional, strategic, and intellectual discipline, long-term planning, an ability to see things, complex things, through to the end. He loves short, stimulating experiences, whether that's a quick deal or any number of other stimulating experiences he likes to pursue. He's just not someone who's managed a complex bureaucracy. His company is essentially a family-owned boutique business. It employs less than 100 people. He's inheriting a federal government, the executive branch of which employs over 2 million people and is authentically global and touches on policies affecting every aspect of American life, from tax policy to healthcare policy, national security, the federal budget, and on and on. And he has absolutely no experience dealing with all of that. Many presidents don't coming into office, but they're saved by their ability to build a strong team, to take advice, and to bring quality people onto their team. And Donald Trump has never taken advice well. He's a solo pilot. He really only consults with his family. And I think what you're going to see emerge in this White House is that Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump are going to become a very important center of power.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I'm going to have to interrupt you at that point. We'll come back. We'll hear more from you and from Kathleen Hall Jamison. Thanks very much to Mary Kate Carey for being with us. On our talking point, will the White House press corps be looking for a new home? Will that be good or bad? Back in a moment with To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Olnebeck with To the Point. Donald Trump has been inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States. The ceremonies are over. The parade is underway. And we're asking the question, what happens next? Mark Bauerlein is professor of English at Emory University. He's also senior editor at First Things. That's a journal on religion and public life. Good to have you with us.
Hello there.
You have said that you are supportive of Donald Trump because This had to happen because of the volatility in the U.S. And the voting public. I don't know if that's an ideological kind of support or something very different from that, but explain it if you will.
I think that Donald Trump is absolutely correct when he talks about the populist need to strike back at the figures in power, people who are believed to pull the levers on our lives, but who are not accountable to us. When Donald Trump talked today about, once again, people becoming the rulers of this nation again, or when he says that you will never be ignored again. Yes, he was talking to the people who feel that they are disempowered in this country because of various things like unelected judges reversing state votes on issues, by unelected bureaucrats issuing regulations, and the constant stream of federal intrusions into people's lives, especially their religious lives, and that we need a voice, a figurehead, to strike back. And I share their sentiment about this need. So when he says a group of people in D.C. have profited nicely in this globalist, internationalist world, but their own constituents have languished, I see that. And I can give you other examples as well.
So what has happened since the transition and with the nomination of the various cabinet members and all of the contentious hearings that have gone on in the meantime that would lead you to believe that Donald Trump can, in fact, deliver to the people the kind of power that he is promising?
You know, I think there we're getting into the big question, Warren. I mean, it's an open question. Donald Trump has promised things, and he's raised the bar very high for himself. He's made a deal with the people, and he does. He does have to deliver. Your previous guests have talked about the necessity of delivering to people, and I think that the real issue here is the volatility of the American public, especially those who supported Mr. Trump. If they sense in the next 6 months that Mr. Trump's administration is sliding back into the old political gamesmanship, if they feel that Exxon is doing great and gas prices are going up and it's hard for us, I think you will see all of his support fade quickly. I think that it is a mistake to regard Donald Trump as a demagogue in that sense of people idolizing him. I frankly believe that time will tell. There is a test underway. And for all the people making predictions about the future, I would ask this question, Warren. Is there any reason that we should believe any predictions about the future? I mean, if you took a year ago and asked 20 experts for a prediction about the coming year, would any of them be right?
I can't answer that question, I'll leave it to our other guests to comment it if they want to. But before you go on, has he made a mistake in appointing a cabinet? He says it's the cabinet with the highest IQ in the history of the country, but it's also the cabinet with the most connections to Goldman Sachs, to Exxon, which you've already mentioned, to fossil fuel companies at a time when there's great concern about global warming, although it's difficult, of course, to predict that far in the future. But has he made a mistake in that regard, particularly with the people he still has to govern who didn't vote for him?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, I am looking less at people's background, at people's profile, and more about keeping an open mind and saying, I'm not going to judge you on any of what you say, anything about what you say, anything about your work experience. I'm not going to judge you on your resume, because in the last several decades, we have looked at people at high levels of government with extraordinary resumes who have proven utter failures and incompetence. So I'm holding off. I'm a wait and see guy. Let's see the facts come in and be willing to turn against people if they don't deliver.
famous book written about the Vietnam War called The Best and the Brightest. Again, Mark Bauerlein is at Emory University. I want to introduce one more guest to our program, Leila Alawa, who is founder and CEO of The Tempest. That's a global media company that's geared toward millennial women. We have, of course, a march on women started tomorrow, which I'm not associating you with, Leila Alawa, because I don't think, as I understand it, you plan to go. But tell us from somebody who feels very much, I take it, on the outside of the current administration, how the inaugural address looked to you, how things are looking to you now. You're in Washington. You've been trying to decide. You've been around town. You've been going to various places to get a sense of who's coming into town, who's going to be part of the pro and anti-Trump people. And so with that endlessly long introduction, tell us how you're feeling about things at the moment.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. So it was quite an interesting experience to listen to President Trump's speech earlier today, one in which it was completely geared towards a very, very select group of individuals, frankly. And with regards to what your previous guest brought up in terms of this, defensiveness on President Trump's side around the constant, around his supporters' feelings of being constantly intruded upon with regards to their religious lives and general disempowerment of these people in middle America, you know, quite frankly, there is a foreboding, a sense, if you will, from millennial women, especially diverse millennial women, which is what the focus of my company works on and is the focus of my life overall, that we are not being represented, nor are we being protected in the months and the years to come by this president's administration and his promises. And frankly, the speech was, in some case, in some senses of the word, jarring and terrifying for someone who as you know, as someone who's hopeful that we can bridge the differences, I was taken aback by the language being used. And here in D.C., you know, there's been an air of apprehension, a lot of hesitation. I work in spaces in which individuals from different backgrounds come to, and you know, I've sat next to folks who are organizing bikers to come down to D.C. around the same time as the Women's March, primarily to make a point. And, you know, like you brought up earlier, I'm not affiliated with the Women's March. And personally, professionally, while I support it, personally, I will not be attending because of fear for my well-being and the safety of those that look like me. As an American Muslim woman who is visibly other in a very tense space in D.C. this weekend.
Let me go back to Mark Bauerlein. You mentioned the intrusions of the federal government into people's religious beliefs. What do you say to Leila Alawa, who represents people who are very, very frightened about what Donald Trump might mean for them and their religion when he has talked as he has, although he may have pulled it back to some extent, about rounding up Muslims or preventing people who are of Muslim faith from coming into the country?
Well, Warren, let me say that when I hear liberals and leftists talk about conservatives or the right raising divisions in America, I find that laughable. If you are a social or religious conservative, and it's a much larger group than millennial women, then you know that in the last half century, you have been in the culture, in Hollywood, all the way up into the Democratic Party, you have been demonized, vilified. You have had some of the noblest religious women in the world, the Little Sisters of the Poor, hauled before the Supreme Court. You feel marginalized constantly. And we are at the point, and I'm one of those, where we've been beaten down so many times in so many ways, and that all the divisiveness comes from the identity politics of the left.
Why don't you then feel some sympathy and some concern for someone like Leila Alawa, who is a Muslim, who is identified by the way she looks, as are many other Muslims and subject to all kinds of discrimination, some of which is similar to what you described, some of which isn't.
I don't want to see discrimination happen everywhere. I mean, for one thing, all of us are identified in some way, in all different ways, by our looks, by our height, by our age, by our region, by our accent. This happens all the time. I don't want to see discrimination. I don't want to see anyone bothered by the way they look. I mean, that's of course, I don't know anyone who, including people in my conservative world, who would say any differently.
Mark Bauerlein at Emory University. Leila Alawa, back to you with The Tempest. What do you plan to do? You're not going to the Women's March. Do you intend to engage in protest in any way? And if so, what would it be?
Well, first, just in response to what your guest said earlier, I'll note that it's pretty fascinating that he immediately marked me as a liberal or a Democrat, because I actually am a conservative and a moderate in the way that I operate my life. And frankly, when it comes to the quote-unquote identity politics that keeps being thrown around, frankly, post-election, the reality is that identity politics comes into play when you are finally having to listen to those that do not look or think like you, the majority narrative of which has been for decades, one that is very Caucasian and male-driven. So when it comes to the work that I'm doing specifically, I the Women's March is a great symbol of what is to come. But my work is specifically looking to disrupt conversations within the media landscape, by providing women from different backgrounds the ability to speak out on policy changes on the political landscape. We're unleashing a policy section specifically to empower those who feel silenced, whether those are folks from the middle of America to folks that consider themselves to be religious minorities, providing them with resources to actually take back the country that, you know, seemingly has been taken from them. So I think that there's a lot to be had. And, you know, the worst way to move forward or the best way to move backwards is really to continue becoming defensive when an individual brings up that they are feeling othered or they're feeling discriminated against. And the only reason that I brought up the way that I look was specifically in response to so-called continued persecution of folks who apparently are a specific height or have a specific accent. Because the reality is that there are palpable emotions that are running through both social media and in person. Feelings of lack of safety, lack of job safety, physical safety, emotional safety, what have you, that while, sure, the social and religious conservatives may be, quote-unquote, larger than diverse millennial women, which I would contest, it's not a reality that we can ignore.
Let me go back to Kathleen Hall Jamison from the first part of our program, a professor at the Annenberg School of Communication, director of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. So here is a divide that is historical in the United States. Do we hear anything from Donald Trump that would suggest that he's attempting to bring these two people together?
Yes. You hear the passage in which he says, "We must speak our minds openly, debate our disagreements honestly, but always pursue solidarity. When America is united, it's unstoppable." You also hear the statement, which I think is an interesting statement, about patriotism and prejudice. So the question is, what do these things mean in practice in this administration, and how are these heard by those people who did not vote for Donald Trump but are looking to this inaugural as a vision of their future?
Timothy O'Brien, back to you once again, the biographer of Donald Trump, Trump Nation, The Art of Being the Donald, now executive editor of Bloomberg View. Do you think Donald Trump is a man who really wants to bring these kinds of differences together?
I think we're going to have to wait and see. I think it's important for the country that he evolves and that he authentically engages with that very issue. Nothing in his past would suggest that he's that person. You know, he's always thrived on conflict, and he, to a certain extent, I think, enjoys public conflict. He sort of revels in it. So I think the question is he going to evolve at age 71 as he inhabits this office? I also agree with Mr. Bauerlein that he is a reflection of a deep-seated anti-institutional anxiety among a large swath of the voters that the elite media, elite corporations, and elite political institutions overlooked. But Bernie Sanders is also a reflection of that same sentiment, the support for Bernie Sanders and the support for Donald Trump. And the question in both of those cases is, what do you do with that sentiment? And Trump has given no indication that tactically he knows how to address those concerns, because they're not. It's an economic response that he's got to address here. It's to the kind of job changes that globalization and technological innovation introduced.
Let me just interrupt you for 1 second, because we've only got about 30 seconds left. What about Jared Kushner and Ivanka Kushner, of course, the daughter of Donald Trump? You've said that they're going to be the two most powerful people in the Trump administration. Very quickly, if you can, are they people who are likely to address themselves to the kinds of issues we've heard about on this program today?
I've coined a term for Ivanka and Jared jointly as Javanka. And I think Donald Trump will be speaking with Javanka in the morning and speaking with Javanka at night when he decides on any policies to the exclusion of his cabinet members. And that's where a lot of the pivotal decisions will reside.
Okay, we will find out what that means as time goes on. In the meantime, many thanks to all of you. Timothy O'Brien, now with Bloomberg View, former biographer of Donald Trump, Mark Bauerlein at Emory University, Leila Alawa, president and CEO of The Tempest, Mary Kay Carey, our earlier guest with the U.S. News and World Report, former speechwriter for George H.W. Bush, Kathleen Hall Jamison at the Annenberg School in Pennsylvania. Thank you all so much, and we'll look forward to talking to all of you as time goes on. Will the White House Press Corps be looking for a new home? Back in a moment with To the Point from Public Radio International. Warren Allen back with To the Point, with our talking point. One unnamed Trump official has said, "We want reporters out of the building." That's raised a provocative question. Does the White House Press Corps have a future? If not, the editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review has a very surprising answer. That just might be a good thing. Kyle Pope, welcome to The Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
As a person who spent a very short time as a reporter in Washington, D.C., I am very interested in your response to this question. Elaborate why you think it might be just as well if the reporters didn't have the kind of access to those big rooms in the White House that they do now.
Well, let me just clarify on that point. I mean, I think, I don't think that they should be thrown out of the White House, but I basically think that it's just symptomatic of what is going to be an incredibly contentious, antagonistic relationship between the press and this president. And I think what I meant by my comment is that it's going to force the press to get a lot more creative, a lot more aggressive, a lot more industrious about how it covers this White House. And I do think that White House reporters in specifically, but probably national political reporters in general, got sort of frankly too used to access and got a little bit the edges were sort of shorn off a little bit, and I don't think it helped. And I think that there was a coziness between especially the last administration and previous Democratic administrations, especially, and the White House press that was not good for, not only good for not for not good for the press, but not that even good for readers and viewers. So this was a corrective, I think, that had to happen. I hope that the reporters stay in the White House, but my point is that if they don't, there's a clear path for how they can still do good aggressive coverage. I actually think at the end of the day, we could end up seeing a kind of revitalized National Press Corps because of this, which I think is great.
Do you agree that most of the reporters that are covering the president are Democrats?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I probably do agree with that. I mean, I think most national reporters at most, especially at mainstream media organizations, are Democrats. But I don't really, I know that's probably, I don't know how controversial a view that is, but I also don't know how relevant it is. I mean, I think that, I think reporters are perfectly willing to, pursue a good story when they see it. I'm not sure how much that's taken into account.
You may not be objective, but you certainly can be fair.
Yeah, but I do think there was a coziness. I mean, I think if you look at, I think one of the sort of really startling things that came out of the WikiLeaks disclosures was these, sort of like really close ties between some in the political press and the Clinton campaign. I mean, they were like, cocktail parties at John Podesta's house that reporters were at, and that was not unusual. I mean, this is fairly common, and I think that over time that became more the norm than not, and I think in a lot of ways it was inappropriate. So that, I mean, I can tell you now that is probably not going to happen with this administration, and I don't think it's a bad thing.
Well, you said at the outset that this is going to be a contentious, antagonistic relationship between the Trump administration and the press corps. Isn't it supposed to be contentious and antagonistic to the extent that the press does have under the Bill of Rights a watchdog function?
That's my point. I mean, I think that when the press takes that stance is when it does best. And I think that there was a period when being a reporter covering the White House meant a lot of those reporters felt that they were as much a part of the White House scene as the people who worked there, and that became not a good thing. And I think, I think one of the themes that Trump touched on during his campaign was this notion that the media was crooked, that the media was part of the elite, that the media was part of the establishment, that the media was unfair. I think that some of what he said was outrageous, but I think that there was a grain of truth in some of what he said as well. And I think that his supporters sort of sensed that. And again, I don't think that they were wrong. I think that there have been moments in the last couple of decades in this relationship between the political press corps and the White House where it did get too close. And I think that Trump has sort of blown that up. And I think let me just be very clear. I think that a lot of what he said has been outrageous. I think that, his mocking and taunting individual reporters, I think his encouragement of his supporters to threaten reporters, which happened again and again during these rallies, was outrageous. I think his talk about loosening libel laws is not at all in line with what somebody who understands what the press's role in a democratic society is about. So it's not like I'm defending his actions. I'm just saying, given that this is who is in the White House, I think the press needs to sort of, come to terms with what it is and sort of get in the mode of dealing with this. I mean, I wrote a piece.
Let me ask you this. Sean Spicer, the new press secretary, has said that the administration may want to pick the reporters from various institutions that get to be in on the press briefings and so on. You have said in that open letter to Donald Trump from the U.S. press corps that the ground rules are ours to set, not yours to set. So are you suggesting that the press corps really does have dominion over the press room in the White House?
I think what the press corps has dominion over is what we show on our airwaves and what we run on our column inches and what we run on our websites. That's ours to control. Similarly, it's ours to control who we put on as terms of spokespeople for the campaign. I mean, if there's somebody who consistently is viewed as not, we think is not credible because of what they say or because of the way they say it, it's our right to say we're not going to have that person on anymore. I mean, it's our responsibility to get a fair comment from the other side, but who that is, we get to choose. I mean, these ground rules, you mentioned the ground rules, which is basically, is something on the record? Is it off the record? Am I going to go to this briefing on background or not? The administration can propose what it wants the ground rules to be, but the media is completely within its rights to say, we don't accept those ground rules. We're not going to go. We're going to have to get the story another way. So, you know, I think that there have been a lot of threats from the incoming administration about what the press is going to have to do. And I wrote this letter as partly to the incoming president, but partly to the press corps to say, like, let's remember who's in control of at least our side of the equation.
Very quickly on this issue of who gets to talk and who doesn't get to talk, there has been a lot of dispute amongst the press corps of late about whether we should put global warming deniers on the air. Well, now we have global warming deniers that are running the institutions that are supposed to deal with global warming or not deal with global warming according to how they feel. What do you do about a situation like that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that I do think, you know, the administration certainly has the right to air its view. I do think that there are areas where there's no factual dispute. And I think it has to do, you know, we heard a lot during the campaign about this false equivalency thing. If somebody says something X and we know it's demonstrably false, do we have to sort of give it the same weight as the true thing? And I think that's what we're going to be dealing with going forward. Okay. And that goes to the choice of, you know, remembering that it's the news organization's choice about who they put on the air.
All right. Come back. Talk to us about fake news. Kyle Pope, editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. We're out of time. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
Our producers this week, Katie Cooper, Andrea Brody, Christine Detz, Jenny Hamill, Paul von Zielbauer, technical director Mike Newport, Joel Stein, Mark Hamilton, managing producer Evan George. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.